Hey everybody, what's up? Chad Wesley Smith here for the Jug Life Podcast. Today's episode is with Ryan Horn. He's the Director of Performance for Wake Forest Men's Basketball, great basketball program in the ACC. We talk with Ryan about training for basketball players, the unique challenges that it presents to train athletes who are so tall, you know, 6'8", 6'10", 7 feet tall, definitely people who are not traditionally thought to be very well built for lifting. So he gives some good solutions for that, as well as just some great ideas and insights into sport performance training. Visit jtsstrength.com, check out all of our online coaching options, our apparel and books, subscribe to the channel, like this video, and find the Jug Life Podcast on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and at jtsstrength.com.
Coming to you from Orange County, California, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith.
All right, Ryan Horn, how you doing, buddy?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
So we're here at the lovely Mamba Sports Academy in Thousand Oaks, California, for their first annual, I'm assuming what will become an annual event. And you're all the way out here from North Carolina, where you're the Director of Basketball Performance at Wake Forest. So tell me a little bit about your coaching journey. What brought you to Wake Forest?
It's been a long path, but a relatively, you know, unorthodox one. You know, starting off in the field, kind of behind the eight ball, not a big network, not really a college weight room to kind of work in once I finished playing. So getting your foot in the door, I've been blessed to only have four stops. I've heard that you're not a real coach until you get fired. I have not got fired yet, so I'm still waiting on that one to come. Hopefully it doesn't happen too soon. But, yeah, before Wake Forest, it's kind of been a different path. You know, I started out at Robert Morris University with Todd Hammer and did my first internship there. Went to Virginia Commonwealth University, was there for 5 years, and worked with a variety of Olympic sports, and had the opportunity to go to University of Tulsa to work with basketballs and football, and that was like kind of the next logical step, you know, after being at VCU. And then, and
were you a basketball player yourself?
No, not at all. Actually, I played football, track and field in high school, and
that would have thrown me off, because when Corey told me that he was a basketball player, that threw me off as well, and it would have surprised me even more.
And that's part of the whole unorthodox path, right? So, you know, you and I have some very similar life stories. You know, I also grew up in the Husky section, so you know, I also, you know, it was very clear from the beginning of, you know, what sports, you know, whether it was baseball, football, and then shot put and discus when I got in high school. You know, it was very clear of, you know, what I was going to be able to do. But then again, you know, being in college, you know, trying to play football, I became much better at training for the sports than I was at them at that level. And it kind of led to what I ultimately wanted to do since I was in 10th grade of high school, which is coach and train athletes at the college level. So that's kind of how it all matched up. Then I left the University of Tulsa almost, you know, 6 seasons now. I'm on my 6th season at Wake Forest, and it's the place I've been the longest of any point in my career. So, you know, I'm really grateful for the opportunity.
So working with basketball players is such a unique population in a couple senses. One, basketball doesn't seem to have, like, training and lifting weights is not a big part of their sport culture. Mm-hmm. And then you get the athletes who are probably most ill-suited to lift weights, like they have the opposite body type of what you want to do. So the first part of that, combating that kind of non-lifting, non-training culture of basketball, how do you go about that with the Demon Deacons?
Yeah, all the cons that you kind of mentioned were all the attractions for me. Uh-huh. You know, never being a baller myself, you know, it's one of those things where, like, the unique, you know, biodynamic, bioenergetic, and biomotor demands of basketball, like, they have to be extremely gifted athletes, and they have to be able to do these things in a lot of ways that no other athlete really faces. So I think the culture piece of it, thankfully, due to the NBA, due to Instagram, due to social media, you're seeing kids come into programs more where physical preparation is something they're really excited about. I can see it when kids come on campus and they're looking at schools, like that's a stop that they want to have now, and that's a discussion that they want to have. So I think it's starting to trickle down from the NBA down to the college level where guys are really starting to embrace it.
And that's, you think a thing of them seeing in scouting reports, like this guy has an NBA body, ready body.
100%. Like no one wants to be labeled as a guy that you can bully, and you got pro bodies, and they have that opportunity to basically, it becomes like, what can you withstand? Like you have this skill. And even the college, you know, physique or the college body compared to an NBA body, you just see such a higher level of skill and athleticism at the NBA level, but not as much push in college where, you know, you're really trying to see people physically change. Like it's a different maturation period. And I think it's really cool to be a part of that and to take guys that I think not necessarily are against it, they just haven't been exposed to it. So I spoke about that earlier. Like they're just very low training age and they haven't really had a chance to really train and go through a physical preparation program, because a lot of what they do is with workout guys and skill coaches. Yeah. So even what they would classify as workouts are still basketball. So I think that's a transition you got to help them make.
Do you see basketball athletes conflating the idea of like sport specific and technique practice a lot, where they're like trying to load the sport movements? You know, they're putting a weight vest on to do different stuff. See that as being like a real problematic thing for basketball players?
Yes, especially like early on in the training process when you should be, you know, focusing on, you know, general exercises and then kind of, striving down from general to specific as we would do it. There's a fascination with specialization. There's a fascination where, will this carry over to the court? And they have to understand and learn that you have to have the physical resources and capacities and tools to do those movements first before you work on really making them transfer or making them stick. So I think it's that education piece. But yeah, they're definitely fascinated, and they really romanticize the whole idea of you can attach a band to anything. You can put a weight vest on for anything. And it's just really taking a step back and like, listen, like this is what we're going to do. There's a time and a place for that. But overall, we got to look at where we invest our money or our time and what's going to give us the biggest return.
So dealing with, you know, athletes who are 6'6", 6'8", 6'10", 7 feet tall, they've been running up and down a very hard surface for, you know, the last 5 to 10 years of their life. Oh, by yeah, the time you see them, you're getting presented with a lot of unique challenges. Mm-hmm. And so what are some things that you focus on for exercise selection and being able to work with these guys who don't necessarily fit in well to like traditional powerlifting, weightlifting movements?
Yeah, and I think it's the first things first, you have to be able to put them in a position to be successful. And I think that when it comes to, let's say, everybody's fascinated with squatting tall athletes, you know, and tall isn't necessarily an excuse. If they're able to get into positions, whether it's using elevated heels, mm-hmm. whether it's using slant boards or wedges to help them find their balance in the squat. What I notice with basketball players, they struggle to find balance in the squat just due to how they're built, how they move their benders, not so much like triple flexion, they bend at the waist. Mm-hmm. And it's like that every time they come in. And it seems to clean up when you can put them in a mechanical position that allows them to utilize what they already have. So you see guys really start to feel better when they're getting that synchronized triple flexion, full range of motion, you know, really putting them in a position to be successful. You see those things really improve. And then too, like a lot of them, you can really load that hinge with them. So what we try to focus on in the summer is anterior chain dominant. When we're not on the court as much, we can push the squat a little bit more, still push the hinge. But then once we get in season, we kind of really focus on loading that hinge movement as our main load, for instance, for the central nervous system or the lower body, and then just greasing the groove with the squat, like keeping it really clean, really fluid, and just keep our athletes moving well. And I think that's a longer term process, but as we talked about before, it's like the short money, long money. Like, where are you going to put your money? And I think it just takes more time, and people usually don't adapt as fast as they want them to. So then they get frustrated, like, we're not doing it. Like, you're just too tall. And there's some kids that really have issues with it. But I think a lot of it just works from the foot up. If you watch our guys move, watch them squat, when they come in, I mean, they're walking around, they got gloves on their feet, and they really have no feel for what they're doing. A lot of that goes back to how we cue them and how we load them. But I do think the ability to have those check downs and those audibles to pick movements that match where they're at right now and kind of meet them where they are, knowing what you ultimately want to achieve.
So to go back to, you said that they've got gloves on their feet.
Yeah.
So by that you mean, yeah, they've been wearing these basketball shoes, yep, to do everything.
Yep.
So the big toe doesn't yeah, flex, and their, mm-hmm, ankles don't move the same way. So that's got to be step one in correcting these guys' movement from the feet up. What are some things you like to do with these guys to get their feet and ankles moving better?
First and foremost, we get them out of their shoes. We get them out of ankle tape. We get them out of their shoes. You know, we let the foot do what it ultimately wants to do. And if you show me a kid with sore knees or bad knees, and, you know, usually the foot is going to feed that hip dysfunction. The foot's going to feed some of the issues they're having, whether it's patellotendinitis or tendinopathy, whatever it may be. A lot of these issues are generating from the body finding a way to do things. So when we say with gloves on, we're talking more about the intrinsic muscles of the foot, like the sensory properties of the foot, like being able to feel the ground and know what you need to be able to do. I mean, I think these are some of the things where we compare it, like with that continuum, like we talked about this morning, like you want spring, but you don't want sledgehammer or wet noodle. So it's like finding this optimal level of stiffness and function within the foot to allow it. And Cal Dietz really spoke to this, and it kind of really resonated with me. It's, you know, you build this big motor, but we don't have the tires to be able to use the horsepower and put it into the floor. So the ability to use, you know, pushing peak eccentric force for the lower leg, like, you know, with flywheels and for direct calf work and for doing things that really load that foot to give it what it needs to be able to manage those forces, I think it's huge. So for us, like, first 20 minutes of session every single day, like a lot of our rhythmic skipping, all of our warm up, all of our human first stuff, all of that is barefooted. And you talked about the surface. I also think the surface is huge. Like, we spend minimal time on the court. We spend a lot of time on field turf, grass, and we also periodize those surfaces over time to kind of play with that structural load to kind of figure out what we want to be able to do. So I think it's definitely a multi-prong approach, but, like, I don't think the answer is need a wall stretch for 3 to 5 reps. Mm-hmm. You know, if get guys on the wall, let's do some ankle mobilizations, then we're good. I think it's way more integrated than that, and the fact of their ability to feel, you know, what they're doing and then moving that. I think that's the big thing for us, is just getting them out of their shoes safely and effectively and using movements that tax the foot, and then just making them cognizant of it. We do different drills every day. Pick your big toe up. All right, just left big toe. Pick your toes up. Keep the big toe down. Like, just getting them to realize they have feet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's been huge for them to be able to conceptualize that.
So with, you know, looking at the different strength movements and giving these 6'10" guys strength stimulus,
mm-hmm,
something that I always promote to coaches, you know, working with sport athletes, not strength sport athletes, is that the movement is more of a category, mm-hmm, than, you know, a specific exercise. That,
exactly.
Like, how much they can squat, who really gives a shit? It's how well do they run and jump. And so finding the you know, quote-unquote squat movement pattern is more effective, you know, rather than being locked into, mm-hmm, barbell squat or front squat is the best thing. Do you have some movements there that you find to be successful more often than not with very tall athletes, basketball players?
Yeah, I think the one great thing about basketball, you alluded to it before, they're not attached to numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So in a lot of sports where you're trying to drive the squat up back, there's not that traditionalist approach and very pragmatic of, like, you got to use these lifts, clean squat bench, whatever it may be. So, like, you don't have to really knock down those walls, which is cool. But yeah, like, what we try to look at is, like, if we're teaching, like, the barbell itself, we haven't used a barbell back squat in a long time. We use safety squat bar. We do utilize some front squatting. Those are two barbell related lifts that I think really fall within our program and what we're trying to do. We do a lot of flywheel squats on the K-box, both harness and with belt. That's probably one of our preferred squat options, just because you do get that peak eccentric force, you do get that flywheel, so you're able to overcome that inertia and work with an athlete that usually lacks the ability to put force into the ground. Kids that are very reactive, elastic, and bouncy, but really don't have the tissue properties to be able to handle that. So we use a lot of flywheel. We actually got into using more Kaiser squats, the pro squat, because we're able to utilize, you know, pneumatic resistance and be able to do that. So, like, my biggest thing is, like, find a way to load them. And you have this pattern, and that pattern's going to drive your programming. And those are movements for us that I feel like really, but even in that human first, like if they can gobble it in a warm up, they can do swings, they can do some of that work. You got to find a way to put them in position. So even if you're doing like a rear foot elevated split squat or a split stand squat, we started doing a lot of those, both like Hatfield supported split squats. And actually one thing we've actually shifted is putting more pressure on the forefoot. So we go back to that foot piece, like how strong is that arch, how strong is that foot, and can it handle it? And that all comes from Cal D. So can we elevate, do forefoot dominant squats, really get the knee over the toe in an athletic position, that spring position? So we've been doing a lot of isometric and submaxicentrics on those as well. So I think those are probably the biggest battery of exercises, loading the supported split squat, the flywheel, the Kaiser, and then your basic barbell movements. But really it's like finding out, okay, you try this, what's it look like, how's it feel? We report back, we don't give them the answers, but we ask them, we assume less, ask more, and then figure that out and move along there. And that's my biggest thing, you already knocked it out of the park, is like find a way to load them. And I think that's where your allegiance needs to lie.
Yeah.
You know?
So. And yeah, especially coaches who may have a background like me in strength sport, whether they come from powerlifting, they want to use powerlifting to coach someone. They come from weightlifting, they want to use weightlifting to coach athletes. And it's just like a huge trap.
100%.
For athletes to fall, for coaches to fall into. So you'd mentioned reactive elastic and talking about guys being bouncy. You know, if there's one universal thing among basketball players, volleyball players as well, as a big population I worked with for a while, they all want to jump higher.
Oh, 100%.
And it's kind of crazy when you look at you know, it's jumping high is associated with basketball players. But if you were to look at like NBA pre-draft camp, NBA combine versus NFL combine results, that standing vertical jump, the NFL player results are so much higher. Mm-hmm. So, you know, why is that the case, and what can basketball players do to, or do they even need to do anything to bring up the difference between like standing vertical and vertical with approach?
Yeah, so that's one of our testing protocols. So we actually measure a standing vert, a non-counter movement jump, and then an approach, like a max jump, like you would see in the NBA combine. We find that the bigger difference between those two, so from a standing jump, anything really above 8 inches between the two, you're starting to get into a guy, we also measure reactive strength index, doing a jump mat, using like a, basically a twitch mat, looking at ground reaction force. But what we find is like there's that big gap because these athletes don't have the explosive strength to be able to do it. So that's a strength issue. And really we're not looking at vertical jump performance. I'm seeing it more as resilience and durability, because if you have a kid that's extremely twitchy, that's extremely reactive elastic, there's a lot of tendon stress, but the muscular strength and neuromuscular coordination to do that in the standing position is just not there. So I see that more as a way to mitigate injury risk and help bridge that gap. Now, you're never going to make it. I've never had a kid be equal and equal on both, so it's hopefully one is higher than the other.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, so but when, they should be higher.
Yeah, they should be higher, but when you're seeing like 12, 14 inches, like this huge jump, like I alluded to, I mean, you got guys jumping 40 plus inches and they're standing verts 25 inches, like that's not impressive.
Yeah,
at that weight and size. You know?
When I was jumping my absolute highest throw on the shot put, I had a 35 and a half inch standing vertical. Maybe I would have had like a 36 and a half inch vertical with approach.
Yeah, and I think that also goes back too. I think there's a little bit more skill involved with the approach jump. If you watch those guys gather, that's one of the most impressive things to me is watching some of these really reactive, elastic kids like really load and just gather and how they produce force and energy. Like you would say, like there's a little bit of valgus, a little bit through the floor, and then they're just able to go and put force on the ground and get up. So I think those twitchy, reactive, elastic type kids, you got to find out whether or not that maximal strength level is where it needs to be to make sure the reactive strength and bridging those two things together. I think you can make a little bit more of a complete athlete that's a little bit more robust and durable.
What is the highest approach vertical that you've seen?
I've ever seen 40. We've had 47 inches was the highest I've ever seen in person.
What's the highest that you believe that you've heard of?
I've heard of 50, like right in low 50s, like 50 inches. There's a couple guys that I've heard that have jumped up. Now
and the numbers that you trust?
See, the one thing you have is, too, is like if you check those combine numbers, you usually see like mid-40s, the high 40. You'll see a couple of those sprinkled in there. But also the approach is standardized. So, like, you might have a kid do an approach jump that's running from the freaking three-point line, running in there and then jumping and going. So I think that standardized of that. But you do see some impressive things. But it's just what they do. And I think, like, when you bring kids into our program, we start to see with some of those drop jumps and see that reactive strength index improve. That really tells us, okay, let's push this
you know, maximal strength loading, whatever it needs to be. Let's find that gap. Let's close it and then be able to retain those abilities and let the sport too. We haven't really talked about that. The sport itself lends itself with athletes that are very responsive and adaptable to those types of stimulus because it's a neuromuscular sport. So they get a lot of benefit. You know, we mentioned James Smith earlier, like that load of sprinting, jumping at the volume they do it at is extremely high.
Yeah, because the sport practice is stimulus. And so often coaches discount that, and maybe because it's hard to quantify volume and intensity of practices. But whether it's a football player, you know, sprinting, blocking, tackling, you know, pushing a defense lineman around, an offensive lineman around, that might not be the same. It's not the same thing as a squat, but it's still stimulus to the legs and upper body and everything. And I faced that a lot with the volleyball players, or rather more so the parents. Really, like, they'd come from volleyball practice where they'd just jumped 200 times, and their number one thing they wanted to improve was to jump higher. And it's like, well, you just jumped 200 times, so how would you jump higher by me making you jump more than you just did?
Yeah, and a lot of them are so fascinated with jumping up, they forget that a lot of it has to do with how much force you can put down.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where you really start. So it's like you're doing all these jumps and you're getting the stimulus and exposure. Like, our job now is to fill the gaps within that and understand what they're getting on the floor and the amplitudes of which they're getting to that. And I think that really helps, like, say, like, okay, like, if you do weighted jumps, like, sometimes the answer isn't more reactive elastic. It could be loaded barbell jumps. Really surf in that force velocity curve and figure out what are the blind spots, what are the weak spots, what things aren't they hitting when they're surfing that curve, and trying to basically balance out or fulfill that athlete. And I know Al Vermeil, that Super Bowl ring, NBA championship ring, legend in our field, you know, that was always in our conversations. That was his big thing with Olympic lifts, with barbell squat jumps, with things of that nature. It fills a very specific role within that continuum of sport and development. So I think you really got to find those gaps. But it's amazing that jumping more isn't always the answer.
Yeah. Do you find with the more reactive elastic an athlete is, that giving them the opposite of what they naturally are is what benefits them the most?
I think from a durability, you know, that durability drives performance piece, and Cal Dietz, and I'm not trying to name drop, but I want to give credit where credit's due. You know, Cal basically took it like a spring analogy. Like, you have this piece of tissue, you have two springs on the end, which is your tendon. You spend too much time on the tendon, you're going to have soft tissue injuries and issues. Those are the guys that are weak. They end up having patellotendinitis. They have constant knee issues because they just aren't strong enough from a tissue standpoint to be able to support that type of load. If you constantly only do tissue dominant work and you're only strained in a certain way, bodybuilding, low amplitude type stuff, then you're going to have issues with your tendons, because those things have to play catch up as well. So I think understanding the difference between, like, having slack and having the optimal amount of tension is really hard to quantify, obviously, but just the fact that you're targeting those two areas. If you have a reactive elastic kid, leverage those strengths, but then work on his maximal strength to help kind of weaponize those weaknesses, I guess you would put it.
So last night I was talking with the other basketball guys here, Corey and Nate, one of the coaches here at Mamba, about how 3-on-3 basketball is now a Olympic sport, or will be in the next Olympics.
Yeah.
And I guess NBA players can't play in it, but I asked them about if they had to put together their ultimate 3-on-3 team from NBA players. So I think I gave Corey the first pick. So Corey's team was LeBron, Kyrie, and who was his post guy? It was LeBron, Kyrie, and maybe Joel Embiid. And then and Nate's team was Jamal Murray,
okay,
KD, and Anthony Davis.
Yeah.
So those players are off the board. Who's
your
team?
Off the board? Geez, you just took all the juice away there.
I mean, I have my team that I picked, which would definitely beat both of their teams, but you go ahead.
Yeah, 3-on-3, a lot of space there to work. You know, I would go with, in that situation, I'm a huge Damian Lillard fan.
All right.
So I throw Damian Lillard in there. I would take Kawhi because he can guard multiple positions.
Yeah.
If you get switched, guard in space. And for a big, be an athletic big, be able to run the floor, let's go with, Anthony Davis was the one I'm thinking about too. Let's see. I'm going to give my boy some love. I'm going to go with John Collins from the Hawks.
All right.
Super athletic kid, can run the floor, high motor. I'm going to show him some love. I trust him.
Yeah, my team was Steph, Kawhi,
okay,
and Giannis.
Okay.
So
that's a good matchup. You got your Giannis is hard to identify though. Like he's kind of like he's right across the spectrum. That dude's a freak. They don't call him a freak. That's a heck of a club right there though.
Yeah,
I like that.
So
if
you got Kawhi, I could maybe put PG in there.
That would be my second choice. Like if I couldn't get Damian and Lillard, I would honestly. No one's talked about James Harden either.
That's what I was gonna say.
So my three guards were either Damian, was James, or was going to be Russ.
Yeah, I mean the guy who's considered to be the best, you know, this transcendent offensive player, but I guess when he's going to have to man someone up on D, I don't know if that's going to work out that well on the other
side. That's where you got to start picking your poison wisely.
What about Billy Hoyt? You want to get him in there?
I don't think so.
I'm going to get Billy Hoyt, Jesus Shuttlesworth,
yeah,
and the guy from the guy from the air up there. Not Kevin Bacon, but the African guy.
Oh, I got
you. Or how about Neon Badeau, Butch Reynolds? I think that's
all from Blue Chips.
Yes.
Yeah, that's definitely a squad right there.
Yeah,
like that's definitely a squad.
Blue Chips, tremendously underrated sports movie.
Oh, tremendously underrated.
Great. And so, you know, like ahead of its time, exposing corruption in the NCAA.
Yeah, we'll talk about that one.
So what are some resources that you would direct people towards? Basketball specific or just anything?
Yeah, I love the class. You know, I think you have to find coaches that are doing what you want to do at the level you want to do it at. You've mentioned Buddy, you mentioned James Smith. He's had a huge influence on me. Some of it can be rather dense and challenge you, but I really love his perspective and while he does it. Anything Buddy Morris writes, I'm going to read. And then I'm really a fan. I grew up on the classics, so like, you know, reading everything that Louis Simmons put out and Matiev and Tudor Bompa and going down and Dr. Zaciorski, like all the way down the line, like I'm really a big fan of those classics because I think you can't really run away from that foundational work. It's hard to really go and dabble and be specialized like we talked this morning without having that base knowledge of understanding. So I would always tell people to revert back to the classic. I mentioned Joel Jameson's book today, Ultimate MMA Conditioning, even though it's not just about MMA. I really enjoyed that as well. So,
awesome. Ryan, thank you very much for taking the time, buddy.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to that episode with Ryan Horn, Director of Performance for Wake Forest Men's Basketball. Hopefully you got some good insights to sport performance coaching. If you work with basketball players or athletes who just aren't that well suited to traditional barbell exercises, I think Ryan gave some really good advice on how to help them still train effectively. Make sure you like this video. Visit jtsstrength.com for all of our online coaching services, apparel, books, all that good stuff. Share this video with your friends. Find The Jug Life on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and at jtsstrength.com. See you next week.